work, that it could save lives, promote world peace, render nuclear weapons impotent and obsolete. Reagan had a sunny, cheerful disposition, but watching the day after left even him feeling depressed. With strong encouragement from his wife Nancy, he publicly called for the abolition of nuclear weapons. Reagan's criticism of the Soviet Union became less severe, and his speeches soon included this heartfelt sentiment: "A nuclear war cannot be won, and must never be fought." The deaths of Yuri Andropov and his successor, Konstantin Chernenko, brought Mikhail Gorbachev to power. Gorbachev represented a dramatic break from the past. He was youthful and dynamic, the first Soviet leader since Vladimir Lenin who'd attended a university. Although Gorbachev's attempts to change the Soviet Union were tentative at first, he was committed to reforming its stagnant economy, allowing freedom of speech and religion, ending the war in Afghanistan, rejecting the use of force against other nations, linking the Soviet bloc more closely to the rest of Europe, and abandoning the pursuit of nuclear superiority. Although many of his views were radical compared to those of his predecessors, Gorbachev did not seek to betray the tenets of Marxism-Leninism. He hoped to fulfill them. In age, temperament, background, education, political orientation, Gorbachev and Reagan could hardly have been more different. And yet they were both self-confident, transformational leaders, willing to defy expectations and challenge the status quo. During their first meeting, at a Geneva summit conference in November 1985, the two men established a personal rapport and discussed how to reduce the nuclear arsenals of both nations. Gorbachev left Geneva viewing Reagan not as a right-wing caricature, a puppet of the military-industrial complex, but as a human being who seemed eager to avoid a nuclear war. A year later, at a summit in Reykjavik, Iceland, the discussion strayed onto a topic that alarmed many of Reagan's close advisors: huge reductions in the number of nuclear weapons. Secretary of State George P. Shultz was elated by the possibility. The recent accident at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant had deposited radioactive fallout across much of Europe and the Soviet Union, reminding the world of the far greater danger that nuclear weapons posed. Reagan and Gorbachev seemed on the verge of reaching an extraordinary agreement, as a transcript of their meeting shows. The president agreed this could be sorted out: cruise missiles, battlefield weapons, sub-launched and the like. It would be fine with him if we eliminated all nuclear weapons. Gorbachev said, "We can do that. We can eliminate them." The Secretary of State said, "Let's do it." The euphoria that Reagan and Shultz felt didn't last long. Moments later, Gorbachev insisted, as part of the deal, that all Star Wars testing must be confined to the laboratory. Reagan couldn't comprehend why a missile defense system intended to spare lives, one that didn't even exist yet, that might never exist, could stand in the way of eliminating nuclear weapons forever. He refused to place limits on the Strategic Defense Initiative and promised to share its technology. The Soviet Union was conducting exactly the same research, he pointed out, and an anti-ballistic missile system had already been built to defend Moscow. Neither Gorbachev nor Reagan would budge from his position, and the meeting ended. Despite the failure to reach an agreement on the abolition of nuclear weapons, the Reykjavik summit marked a turning point in the Cold War, the start of a process that soon led to the removal of all intermediate-range missiles from Europe and large cuts in the number of strategic weapons. The all-out nuclear arms race was over. Gorbachev now felt emboldened to pursue reform in the Soviet Union, confident that the United States did not seek to attack his country. And the hardliners in the Reagan administration breathed a sigh of relief, amazed that their president had come so close to getting rid of America's nuclear weapons. Margaret Thatcher, the conservative prime minister of Great Britain, and François Mitterrand, the socialist president of France, were furious that Reagan had questioned the value of nuclear deterrence a strategy that had kept the peace since the Second World War. Although European protest marches had focused mainly on the United States for the previous 6 years, it was the leadership of Western Europe who most strongly opposed creating a world without nuclear weapons. Bob Purifoy had become a vice president at Sandia, and his new status enabled him to lobby more effectively for nuclear weapons safety. By 1988, almost half of the weapons in the American stockpile were fitted with weak-link, strong-link devices, and the safety retrofit of Mark 28 bombs had finally resumed. But SAC was still loading about 1,000 short-range attack missiles onto its bombers on alert. Those planes were parked on runways nationwide, ready to take off from bases in California, Kansas, Maine, Michigan, New Hampshire, New York, North Dakota, South Dakota, Texas, and Washington State. As tensions between the United States and the Soviet Union eased, the Air Force's willingness to risk an accident with a SRAM became harder to justify. On February 26, 1988, Purifoy wrote to the Assistant Secretary for Defense Programs at the Department of Energy and invited him to Sandia for a briefing on the dangers of the SRAM. The Assistant Secretary never replied to the letter. The following month, the President of Sandia raised the issue with another official at the DOE, who suggested that the Secretary of Energy and the Secretary of Defense should be briefed on the matter. But nothing was done. A few months later, an independent panel was commissioned to look at management practices at the Department of Energy, and Purifoy was asked to serve as a technical advisor. Headed by Gordon Moe, a former member of Henry Kissinger's national security staff, the panel wound up using the SRAM's safety problems as a case study in mismanagement. Moe was shocked by the lack of attention to nuclear weapons safety and its implications. Almost 15 years had passed since concerns about the SRAM were first expressed, and yet no remedial action had been taken. The potential for a nuclear weapon accident will remain unacceptably high until the issues that have been raised are resolved, the Moe panel said in a classified report. It would be hard to overstate the consequences that a serious accident could have for national security. John H. Glenn, a former astronaut and a Democratic senator from Ohio, visited Sandia on April 26, 1989. Purifoy took the opportunity to give Glenn a briefing on nuclear weapons safety and handed him a copy of the Moe panel's report. Glenn wanted to know more about